This event is being sponsored by many groups in the community, but primarily by the public libraries across the county. And they are the Ann Arbor District Library, Chelsea District Library, Dexter District Library, Milan Public Library, Northfield Township Area Library, Saline District Library, Ypsilanti District Library, and the Washtenaw Intermediate School District. And to those directors, staffs, and boards, we thank you. I'm asked how these books are chosen, and the directors of the libraries are always glad to say, we didn't do it. There, over the summer, a screening committee of individuals from all over the county, school students, librarians, people in community government got together and read hundreds of titles and brought it down to two. And then each library was asked to invite someone from their community to read those two books, and there was a vote. And the persons who were asked to vote on this title were Mary Christensen, Paul Courant, Barbara Davenport, Dr. Benjamin Edmondson, Jason Lindauer, and Val Mann. And if you are with us this evening, we thank you very much. I was heartened when I read the book to read where the public library played such an important role as a place in the lives of so many of the people whose stories you'll hear more about tonight. And I can only say, as the director of one public library in the county, who has worked in two others in the county, and has known people for many years who've worked in the others, that our public libraries in Washtenaw County are places where all are welcome, all the time, without question. And we're here to celebrate that tonight with the choice of the county read that we've made. So we're glad you're here. Thank you. And this is my good friend, Lori Coriel, who's director at Chelsea District Library. And it's her pleasure and privilege to introduce our authors. Lori.
Good evening, everyone. Now, you know that the book that was chosen was $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America, by Catherine J. Eden and H. Luke Schaefer, a powerful book delivering new evidence and ideas to our national debate on work, income inequality, and what to do about it. The book won the prestigious Hillman Prize for Book Journalism by the Sidney Hillman Foundation, was shortlisted for the J. Anthony Lucas Book Prize by the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism and the Nieman Foundation, and was named a New York Times Notable Book and a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice. The authors are here with us tonight. Catherine J. Eden, PhD, the Bloomberg Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Public Health at Johns Hopkins University, is the co-author of Promises I Can't Keep, Why Poor Women Put Motherhood Before Marriage, and Making Ends Meet, How Single Mothers Survive Welfare and Low-Wage Work. She received her PhD from Northwestern University and has taught at Rutgers University, Northwestern University, the University of Pennsylvania, and most recently, Harvard University, as a professor of public policy and management at the Harvard Kennedy School and chair of their multidisciplinary program in inequality and social policy. H. Luke Schaefer, PhD, is an associate professor here at the University of Michigan School of Social Work and the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy, where he studies poverty and social welfare policy in the United States. He's an elected member of the National Academy of Social Insurance and received the 2013 Early Career Achievement Award given by the Society for Social Work and Research. He received his PhD from the University of Chicago in 2008. His research focuses on the effectiveness of the United States social safety net in serving low-wage workers and economically disadvantaged families. Together, Eden and Schaefer have created something truly remarkable in $2 a Day, a thought-provoking and moving work that combines data, history, and policy with a compelling, humanizing narrative. As a librarian who fervently believes in the power of stories to change lives, and the stories of $2 a day have that power. I'm honored to welcome Catherine Eden and Luke Schaefer tonight.
Try again. Okay. It's always the most fun to play in front of a hometown crowd. So, when we first got together, we thought that this was going to be a small policy brief, and then it was going to be a magazine article. But as we delved deeper and deeper to try to understand extreme poverty in the United States, became a book. And it's a book, of course, about public policy and some of the changes that we've made in our government programs and how those have affected families. And it's a book, of course, about low-wage work and the unstable and sometimes perilous low-wage labor market that many of our families experience. And it's a book about affordable housing and a crisis in being able to put a roof over your head and over the head of your children. But when I think about the most important piece of $2 a day for me, I think what was most meaningful for me is that it took me, it gave me the opportunity to meet people and go to places that I likely would have never seen before, because we live in such a stratified, separated society. In many ways, we are geographically disconnected, those with means and those without. But even those of us who live in the same places can go about our daily lives without ever knowing. It's almost like we're living parallel lives, that we're in the same places, but never in the same spaces. So this was a book that really took us to places and helped us hear and have the privilege to tell the stories of a set of people that we never would have gotten to otherwise. So one person that comes to mind with this is Ray McCormick. So we met Ray McCormick in Cleveland, Ohio, and she had just recently lost her job at a Walmart outside of Cleveland where she was a cashier, and she loved that job. She absolutely loved it because it was a shelter from the storm. It was an opportunity to have control when she had no control over the rest of her life. And she had actually, in the 6 months that she was there, she was named Cashier of the Month twice because she had this amazing strategy where she would take the barcodes from the most popular produce items and read them into a recording device in her phone. And then set it to play on repeat overnight. So she would hear them over and over again, and she said, by the morning, my subconscious had done the work, and she could key in all of these barcodes from memory. So she had been working this job for 6 months, and she lived with a number of people and shared a truck together that she used to get to work, and she got into her truck one day, and the gas light was on, and she'd given $50 to put gas in the car, and her uncle, George, had used up all the gas, and they got in this huge fight, and they got, somehow he blamed it on her, even though he had used the gas over the weekend running errands, and she called her manager at Walmart and said, can you float me a loan? Can you help me find someone who can get me a ride to work? And he said, if you can't get in today, don't bother coming in again. And so she's getting no support, I think, either from her family or from her work. So that's the story. That's the story we tell in the book. But I think maybe the space that will always stay with us is the house, the last house that we had seen Ray in, and sort of the experience of it being in that space.
So, you know, a lot of people say to us, oh, I don't know anybody in this category. What we learned from the research is that you run into these folks all the time because the call a $2 a day poor person? Here we go.
The typical $2 a day poor person is very much a worker and is in and out of that world of work all the time. So, you know, if you met Ray McCormick at Walmart, where she earned the designation of two-time cashier of the month, you would have no idea that when she lost that job at Walmart, she would spiral into the world of the $2 a day poor, a world she had actually inhabited on and off since she had been 12 years old. Her father had died, and her mother had followed a lover into the foothills of Tennessee, leaving Ray at 12 alone with only her father's Social Security death benefits and her pit bull, Sweetie. Ray, you know, has a really positive demeanor, really a sweet smile. The only thing that might tip you off that something is wrong is that when she smiles and opens her mouth, her hand goes like that. Because lacking any kind of dental care as a child, Ray lost all her teeth at the age of 19. But it was really only in following Ray home to the place where she was living with this fictive kin, this Uncle George and his partner, Camilla, and the various boarders they had taken in, that you get some sense of unbelievable conditions some of these folks live in. So I remember clearly, if you drive up to this place, it looks pretty good on the outside, right? It's got you know, the vinyl siding. Unlike a lot of homes in this neighborhood, in the Stockyards neighborhood of Cleveland, it's, you know, the gutters are intact and so on. But when, you know, the porch is fairly nice, there are no sort of broken spindles. But when you walk through the door of that house, it is a different scene entirely. Just before Ray and this sort of cast of characters, you read about them in $2 a day, there's the elderly boarder who has, you know, trouble controlling his bowels, who loves to sit on the porch, and, you know, the couple who claims SSI, all of them basically turning over their benefits to George, who then provides for the family. Ray, of course, does the same with her meager earnings from Walmart and her food stamp benefits. But this house has been raided by scrappers just before this family has moved in. So they've signed the contract, they've paid first and last month's rent, and they move into this house where all of the copper tubing that carries the water has been torn out. So the only way to get water into the house is to actually go into the basement and turn on the main spigot and sort of capture the water from a broken pipe in buckets. Ray tells about how old George, you know, sits on the top step. He's this elderly man who can barely walk, who they've taken in exchange for his Social Security benefits. And he sort of coaches as they try to put together some rudimentary plumbing with old pipes and duct tape. And then the bucket brigade that gets the water up to flush the toilets and to give Ray's daughter, Azara, a bath. Later, I was just telling recently Ray that we often told the story of her house, and she said, well, every time they flushed that toilet upstairs, you know, that would leak into the back bedroom on the first floor. Believe it or not, there was no stove that was functional in this house, and in fact, the kitchen was a lean-to that was barely hanging onto the house. You know, the roof so low you sort of had to walk into that space, you know, with your knees bent or with your head tucked. All of the wiring had been ripped out of the house by scrappers except one outlet. So everywhere around this house there were extension cords, one after another, snaking through the house. If you are wondering where the pipes went, you have only to turn to the story of Travis, who we met in Johnson City, Tennessee. So you probably remember, if you've read the book, about Travis and Jessica and the plasma sales, and I'm going to get to that in a minute. But prior to being solely reliant on plasma, during those months when employers would reduce their hours to zero as foot traffic slowed in that seasonal economy, Travis had a truck. And this truck was sort of his prized possession. He used it to sort of comb the highways and the residential neighborhoods of little towns around Johnson City, Tennessee, taking anything of value and bringing it to the scrapyard. So, they were kind of living off, in a very minimal way, off the scrapping. But then one day, a cop pulled Travis over for having an expired plates and impounded the car until Travis could basically pay the fines and get new plates for the car. So this takes weeks. He borrows from everybody he can think of. He saves. Jessica goes out and sells plasma. They do everything they can to get the requisite funds to get this car out of hock and get it back on the road. He thinks he's got the money, and he's at the DMV about to pay his fine when the cashier tells him he's $25 short. Now, just then, the woman behind him taps him on the shoulder and says, "God told me to give you this." Hands him a $100 bill. So he pays the fine, right? He pays the fine. He puts gas in the truck. He's so excited. He's driving home to tell Jessica this meager livelihood between stints at his low-level service job has been restored. And right there on the highway, on the way home, the truck breaks down. He then calls the tow truck. The tow truck comes and gets the car. It hauls it to the garage, and they learn. This, by the way, is an outtake. This story isn't even in the book, so this is like amazing, right? You're getting the outtakes here tonight. Hauls it to the garage and learns that it needs a $200 part. He knows he doesn't have it. He knows there's no food at home. He's already behind in the rent. So he sells the truck for scrap, leaving the family completely dependent on Jessica's plasma donations as the only source of cash coming into that household.
So we really didn't know anything about plasma sales when we started this book. And actually, we've learned a lot since $2 a day came out. But we came across plasma when we kept on seeing divots in the inside crease of people's elbows. And of course, we started to wonder, what are those from? And what's going on? And through the course of conversations with Jessica, Travis's wife, we learned that she, like many who we met, was donating, or you might rather say selling, her blood plasma twice a week, as much as the law would allow, every week. So Travis can't sell his plasma because he has a number of tattoos, and you have to document exactly when you got those tattoos. But at the time when we came into their lives, Jessica was going as much as she could, and she had an entire routine. So she was pretty thin, about 110 pounds, and often her iron levels would be too low. So they would use a little bit of their food stamps benefit to buy iron-rich bars, which she would eat along the way to try to pump that up. And if her heart rate wasn't in the right at the right level, also she wouldn't be allowed to donate. So imagine sort of this, being caught in this situation where you have to keep your heart rate down or you won't get the money that you need is the only cash that's coming in for your family. So she would go to the public library in Johnson City and check out a book. In the time when we first started talking to her, it was a series of Nicholas Sparks books. And she would use that as a way as she was waiting and waiting, trying to use that as a way to calm and concentrate her body so that she could pass it. And then she would wait, to get taken back, and she would sort of flip through all of the health questions that you have to walk through, and then she would go into the back room and lay down on the table and watch as the plasma was extracted from her arm. So Kathy and I, when the book came out, did an excerpt for The Atlantic on this very experience, on Jessica's experience. And that was probably the thing that got shared the most and that we heard the most about in the first days. And then we very quickly got a sternly worded letter from the International Plasma Association, which said, you know, it's okay for you to talk about poverty, but could you please remind people that plasma is an important treatment in a lot of life-saving treatment for a lot of serious illnesses. So, plasma is an important life-saving component of a lot of treatments for serious illnesses. It also turns out the United States is the only country in the world with a plasma market that allows people to donate twice a week because of the fears of physical health. And in fact, the United States accounts for 65% of the world's plasma supply. So we export the plasma, mainly of poor Americans, all around the world. The Plasma Association didn't tell me to say any of this part. The number of plasma sales has tripled over the last decade. To 2015, we hit 35.5 million for-profit sales of blood plasma all around the country. And if you go to Cleveland or down the road here in Michigan, you can often find spaces where you can see a bus stop, and sometimes right next to a public benefits office, sometimes right next to a plasma center. And you see the bus stop in Cleveland, I think there's a place we can both picture where the bus would stop and everybody gets off and everybody goes into the plasma center. And looking at the crowd, you're certain that this is not something that they're doing only out of the goodness of their heart, although that may be a big part of it, but because they have no other source of cash income. So waiting is a big part of the spaces that a lot of our families experience. And one of, I think, our favorite families that didn't make it into the book is Monique. So Monique is a single mother of two, and her story, as we know, it started out in Birmingham, Alabama, where she was living with a grandfather, and she and her kiddos were playing in the front yard, two little boys, and some gang gunfire erupts, and she drops on the boys, and she says she could actually, her ear got tinged, sort of got hot as a bullet whizzed by, and she said, "I'm done with Birmingham, Alabama." So she called up to Chattanooga, Tennessee, where she knew there was a family homeless shelter, and said, "You know, can we come up? Do you have a spot?" And they said, "Yes, yes, we have a spot." And so she and the boys got on a Greyhound bus and headed up. And by the time they got there, that spot had evaporated. And they said, "You know, just wait. Come back tomorrow. We'll have a place for you." So she had a little money saved up from her earned income tax credit. That's a subsidy that she got as a result of her job, or low-wage job. It's one of the best pieces that we did as a social policy in the 1990s, but it's not something you get when you lose your job. So she started paying, I think, $80 a night to stay in the local hotel, and day one she comes back and she says, they say, "Nope, we don't have a spot yet, come back tomorrow." She comes back again, she comes back again, and finally they say, "We're going to have a spot for you tomorrow, one more night. Just come back in. We promise." And she has no money left in her checking account. And she makes a decision that she's just going to write this check with no money left in her account. You know, we'll be in the family homeless shelter by the time they figure it out. I'll make everything right. I always have. And it'll be OK. And she gets a call asking her to come down to the front office, and she doesn't think that much of it, but she gets down there and the police are there. They've called in the check, found out that there was insufficient funds, and called in the police. And they're going to take her down to the station. So again, she has to make the split-second decision. Do I tell them that my kids are upstairs watching cartoons? Maybe, you know, they're watching cartoons, they're pretty happy. I think maybe I can get to the station, clear all this up, and be back in time. Or do I tell them and risk them being put in the foster care system, which she had grown up in and was the absolute worst sort of outcome that she could think of? She makes a decision that they're safer in the room than they are in the hands of the police. And she goes down to the station. I have little kids, so of course, it makes total sense to me that the one time you needed them to be quiet and actually watch cartoons, one of them starts to miss mom and starts crying. The neighbor in the room calls down, and the police find the kids, and they go into the foster care system. So Monique does everything that she can to get the kids back. She finds a job. She finds a place to live. The only time she got into trouble was when she showed up at the house without permission because she was just missing him so much. She was sort of like spying on them next door. And you're not supposed to do that. So she gets the kids back after a year. And she says, you know what, I've had enough of Chattanooga, Tennessee. And they moved to Johnson City, and that's where we met her. And she gets a job at McDonald's, 30 hours a week, $8 an hour. And they're working, and things are going along. And then one day, she gets her check, her paycheck, so her two-week paycheck, 30 hours, you know, $8 an hour. You can do the math. And the check is
$64.
And she says, I'm pretty sure that doesn't add up. And she goes to her manager and says, what's going on? It turns out that the state of Tennessee charges families child support for the time that their kids are in foster care. So Monique owes back the entire arrearage of the cost of raising her kids for the whole time that they had been taken from her, and it's compounded at 15% interest. So I think this is another part of what it means, is that there are systems that that many of us with means might sometimes be ambivalent about, but are often thought to be protective, can be a huge part of the problem. So in Monique's case, when I'm looking at $2 a day poverty and our best source of data, it's not taking into account, it's her gross income. I don't even see the fact that she, you know, she's making an income above sort of $2 a day, but what she's actually bringing home is a great deal less.
And in fact, she qualified as $2 a day poor while working at the job once the wage garnishment
right.
started. Yeah. So, you know, $2 a day is going to be a documentary. We're working with a really talented filmmaker, Jennifer Redfern, and we've been taking her around to these places and showing her the kinds of things we saw when we were in the field. And this this has been such a remarkable experience because we have just happened in on situation after situation that just amplify the themes of $2 a day. So this summer, we took the film crew to this lovely, really one of the loveliest food banks I've ever been in the country on the Detroit Shore Way in Cleveland. Lots of amazing people working there. And so we had gotten permission beforehand to film there. And as we were getting out of the car, there was this trio waiting along the brick wall for the food pantry to open. And so I went up and approached this woman and these two men, and I learned that indeed they were waiting for food. And in fact, the woman told me that she hadn't eaten Marie in 4 days. So she was really excited. She was there with her partner, Jose, and another friend of theirs. Jose had a little cart like the kind you get if you don't have a car and you're walking back and forth to the grocery store. He had also been hungry for days. And as we began talking to her, she told this terrible story of how Jose had been employed at an auto factory down the road, and they were doing pretty well. They had a couple of kids. Their oldest daughter had a newborn, and they were making it. She had a car, and she was cleaning houses for rich suburbanites until the day when Jose lost that job. He was laid off and was not brought back on. And so she related how little by little the family circumstance began to deteriorate. One of the first things that went, of course, was that car. And once the car went, Marie could no longer work as a maid. Nobody in her neighborhood had the wherewithal to hire a cleaning service. And the place that she worked for didn't offer transportation to the woman who worked for that service. So the family was suddenly without income. Not surprisingly, soon they were evicted. But they had a friend, and this friend's father, this is the friend who was standing next to them in line, this friend's father had a place to live, an apartment, and the apartment had a basement, an unfinished basement. And so he offered the family, he said, you know, if my landlord finds out you're in my apartment, I'm going to get evicted because he doesn't want kids in the apartment. He doesn't want someone running up the water bill or tearing up the house. But I think I can hide you in the basement. And so this is literally, you know, a dirt floor. The family is huddled up, you know, sort of squeezed between the radiator and the hot water heater and the other accoutrements of you know, the systems and plumbing for the house. You know, sleeping on the floor with this newborn, a couple of middle school children, and sure enough, the landlord gets suspicious when he sees that water bill. So, in the middle of the night, of course, this is illegal. He opens the back door to the unit, goes down to the basement, and he finds this family. He says to the guy on the lease, he says, "You know, you got to get them out of here. You know, this was, I'm going to evict you." And he said, "I refuse to do that to this family." So the entire group had been evicted. So they had been living at a homeless shelter, and one by one, Marie was facing the tough moral choice about what she was going to do with these kids because school was approaching. And so one by one, these kids were being farmed off to distant relatives. She'd never been apart from her children. That morning, she had just said goodbye to the last child who was going to live with a distant relative in Florida. The only place that she and Jose could find was a small studio apartment, and of course it would be illegal to keep the kids in such a small location without their own bedrooms and so on. So she was facing the heartbreak of having to sort of farm out all of her children. Also, she'd been evicted, and so her name couldn't appear on the lease. The two had signed for the studio only, Jose. So I tell you that detail to sort of set the scene. So we're waiting outside, we're filming this whole story. Then we go in to the food pantry where, of course, you take a number, you see an eligibility specialist, right? There are very strict rules regarding food and food pantries all across the United States. You have to have proof of residence. You can't go too often and so on. And so, you know, she's sitting there in the front, sort of in the front row, right? And all of this food is arrayed in front of her. She hasn't eaten for 4 days. You know, there's the fresh fruits, and there's the canned goods, and there are loaves of bread sitting there. And she's really, you know, excited. So she goes in to see the eligibility worker and comes back out. And she said, "You know, I don't have my name on the lease. I can't get any food. They just told me I was rejected." So imagine, you know, waiting you know, for half a day at that food pantry only to be told that because you're homeless, you can't get groceries, even though you've been hungry for 4 days. But you have some experience with this particular food bank as well.
Yeah, well, so Ray McCormick, you know, we are in touch with some of the families in the book and not others, as their numbers have changed and their, you know, they've just moved on and we've gone to where they're moving, but given, you know, the residential instability, But Ray we're still in touch with, and she wrote me one day to say that they had no food in the house, and she didn't know what she was going to do. And I decided that was, you know, I was going to spend an hour. I said, I'm going to spend an hour, and I'm going to find her some food. And so I called down. She was in Cleveland, and I didn't know the Cleveland landscape very well, but, you know, there's the 211, the information hotline that can tell you about benefits that are available. So I called that and just, you know, started with the very top of the list. And I'm sitting in my very comfortable office, you know, two or three blocks from here. And I have this very vivid memory of calling and it saying, your call will be answered in 8 minutes. And there was fairly pleasant weighty music, you know, so I just had it on speakerphone, but you know, a little while later it said, your call will be answered in 5 minutes, 2 minutes. And then it started to ring, and it immediately went to voicemail. And I think I might have destroyed my phone that day. And I don't know what my colleagues next door thought, but just this sort of act of like, Jesus, if you're gonna send me to voicemail, you could have done it 8 minutes ago, you know, and I'm not sort of working on limited minutes. And, you know, so I called another place and got immediately to voicemail then, but the message said, you know, we're sorry we can't take your call, but there's so much need right now, there's so many people, we can't possibly return phone calls, so don't bother leaving a message. Try back later. And I don't think, you know, just sort of this feeling of rejection, I think, in isolation, right? It wasn't me, I wasn't hungry, but the experience of not knowing if there's gonna be anybody who cares. I called two or three more places and couldn't get someone. And I don't blame any of those places, right? I maybe blame the first one a little bit. Just put me to voicemail. You know, don't make me wait for 8 minutes. But I don't blame any of these places because they are so flooded with need. But from the other side, it feels like, you know, you're all alone, that there's nobody there, that there's nobody who cares. And we've been learning, you know, a lot more about from psychology. Our friends in psychology, this great literature on social rejection, and when you're socially rejected, it actually triggers a lot of the same brain activity as physical pain. So it's like you've been punched.
What do we do about it?
So we've heard that the book is depressing, and we're sorry about that. You can blame your public library and what an incredible system you have, you know, here. But you know, we've been thinking a lot about this, and you know, obviously, sort of the parameters of what can be done and what we should be thinking about changed quite a bit over the last few months. But I was really struck reading a biography of Robert F. Kennedy, who did this. I think completely unprecedented trip to South Africa during the age of apartheid and met with leaders who were fighting for equality during a time when some of those leaders were under permanent house arrest. You know, so for a sitting US senator, brother of a dead president, to go was something that I think had never happened before and was a statement. And he gave a speech while he was there, and I just wanted to read a little bit to us tonight. and I hope that RFK won't mind that I'm going to change the gender of the writing given the day that we're in. Few will have the greatness to bend history itself, but each of us can work to change a small portion of events, and in the total of all those acts will be written the history of this generation. It is from numberless diverse acts of courage and belief that human history is shaped. Each time a woman stands up for an idea or acts to improve the lot of others or strikes out against injustice, she sends forth a tiny ripple of hope. In crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current which can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. Of course, to adhere to standards, to idealism, to vision in the face of immediate dangers takes great courage and takes self-confidence. But we also know that only those who dare to fail greatly can ever achieve greatly.
It's kind of an incredible gauntlet, really, challenge.
Yeah.
So, but what can we do?
Well,
I mean, how do we put that into action?
We've got some of the great social service agencies in the world, maybe I'll say, right outside the door here, who are ready to give opportunities for help. I think social service agencies that have been struggling to do right by those who are struggling and are right here in our community. So I think working with them is a great way. What else?
You know, I remember a former student read $2 a day, and she was really struck by the story of Mr. Patton, this volunteer teacher from Teach for America, who'd come down for Baltimore, actually, to the Delta on a dare, and stayed for a decade to serve the children that he met there as fifth graders. And what really struck her about Mr. Patton's story was the relationship that he built with his students and their families. And of course, if you've read the book, you know that that relationship leads to the rescue of Tabitha from this tiny little Delta town in a terrible situation. Perhaps really the only somewhat happy ending in the book. But Sarah Dillard, my former student, writes about the vital charge to all of us to bridge the gap of social distance by finding a way, perhaps through a tutoring program, perhaps from volunteering at the library, perhaps for working with a literacy campaign or a food stamp outreach effort, to find a way to build a relationship with a person, with a family, who you can know and whose story you can learn, and who could learn your story as well.
Yeah, so maybe whatever we do, whether it's working with legislators and policymakers for policies that you think make sense, you know, we have some ideas at the end of the book, and you may have other ideas, working in with our social service agencies, or you know, the libraries, which we refer to in the book as the living rooms of the extreme poor, some of the last safe spaces that a lot of our families could go and spend time as a family and check out books and be a part of a community. But whatever those things are, I think that we do, and not worrying, are we doing the right thing necessarily, but whatever those things are that we do, I think doing them in a way that builds those social connections, that enhances the dignity of people, because you know, through all these streams, right, all of these different themes, I think one thing that came to us out of this book was the importance of dignity as a basic building block of humanity. So many of our families, I think the parents would gladly go hungry for a day or a few days if they could be treated with respect. And I think that connection and the dignity is something that can make life better for everyone. So in the example of Ray McCormick, she and I were walking one day, and I was telling her that my son Michael, who's now three, he was about 1.5 at the time, just was crazy for bananas. He would eat as many bananas as I would let him. And she looks at me and she says, "I don't think you should give him more than 2 bananas a day." And so that's now my Ray McCormick rule, that at least on my watch, Michael doesn't get more than two bananas at one setting. So sometimes I think it's maybe not so much what you do, as how you do it. And so much of our policies work to strip away the dignity of poor families. So if we can find ways to enhance that dignity, I think we'll all be much better for it. Thank you.
So there are microphones up front. Come on up, and we'd love to field your questions.
I have to admit, I haven't read your book, but I think we're all familiar with many, many stories of poverty, either from the media over the last many decades, or politicians, or whatever. And what higher level analysis might you give, other than doing things to help some of these individual people, or through agencies such as the ones in the lobby? I mean, isn't there a political, social, economic, organizational issue here that creates this whole system?
Yeah, at the societal level, we offer three recommendations at the end of the book, and we really started those recommendations based on what we heard from the families who we met with. So we'd often ask, if we came back in a year and you were doing better, if things were going well for you, what would it look like? And strikingly, to a person, they would say, I'd be making $10 to $12 an hour in a job with 30 hours a week, guaranteed in a stable schedule, in a place of our own. Right? That was the American dream to so many of our families. So that's where we start. We say we need to do a lot more to guarantee that there's living wage jobs out there for those who want them, because there's just no getting around the fact that there's not enough jobs to go around, and there's often a displacement between those who need them and the jobs that are available. And so there's a lot, I think, of work that we can do there. Now, there's always going to be those who can't work, or there's reasons why families might need time at home. So we think that there should be a stable cash safety net that catches people when they fall. And right now, our current program, TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, isn't fulfilling that in many parts of the country. So I think reforming that is very high on our agenda, or finding some other way to provide some sort of stable source of cash support for families at the bottom. And then, of course, there's an issue of affordable housing, where we have so many families who are spending 30, 50, 70% of their incomes on housing, leaving nothing for anything that's else. So that's at the societal level. One of the things I'm very excited about is all of the energy at the local level to make policy changes that matter. We're getting into the game here at the University of Michigan as well. We've just launched a new initiative called Poverty Solutions. And our goal is to work with community stakeholders, work with community groups, and policymakers to really find out what works and what doesn't work, and how can we improve what we do at the state, at the city, at the local level. So we're proud to be partnering with the state of Michigan, evaluating a very innovative program that provides jobs to those who need them, called Community Ventures. We're very proud to be working with nonprofit organizations in the city of Detroit, with some of our faculty from the Institute for Health Policy Innovation, to do a large infusion of community health workers there, because we know that that's an effective way to deliver healthcare services. So we want to see, can we create a viable model? So I think there's very few examples where a university has had presidential support for an initiative like that, and I think it's an exciting time. If you check out poverty.umich.edu, you can learn more about that.
I just want to build on that a little bit. If you haven't read the book charts the growth in the number of families with children living on virtually no cash since the welfare reforms of 20 years ago, from about 600,000 in 1996 to now 1.5 million adults at any given time, with 3 million children, and 1.7% of all children, about 1.3 million children, are living in that state for 7 months out of a calendar year. So part of the premise of the book is that the cause is really the demise of our cash safety net. And it's a demise no one's really noticed. But if you look at the numbers coming out from our federal government, the federal government turned our cash welfare system into a block grant 20 years ago. It said to states, we're going to just keep sending you the same amount of money we sent you in the mid-1990s every year. You can do with it, you know, what you please, as long as you keep to some very broad parameters. We're not going to monitor you very much. And what states have done is they've diverted, of that $16.5 billion, they've diverted all but $5 billion away from cash assistance. So in the state of Michigan, you fund with your TANF dollars college scholarships for middle-class kids. Okay, Massachusetts does this as well. In Louisiana, your cash welfare system is funding crisis pregnancy centers. In Texas, it's funding the child welfare system. The same can be said of Oklahoma. When governors feel the pinch, as they often do, TANF, the cash safety net, has become this flexible funding stream, almost irresistible candy for governors to use to fill state budget holes. And in those cases, we argue that you know, TANF has become welfare to states, not just welfare for the people. So we're taking money from the poor, we're giving it away to other groups of people, some of them not even close to being poor. We're all turning a blind eye to what's happening, and as a result, we have people living on cash income so low that we didn't even think to look for it in the United States because we didn't think it existed.
Hi. So I did read the book, and I was dismayed, of course, at the few options available to people for getting cash in their pocket when work was not a viable option. But it just really disturbed me that this so much of it was taking place in Chicago, which has one of the most vibrant street papers in the world, Streetwise. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't mentioned at all. Nobody seemed to take that as an option. And in your suggestions at the back of the book, that was street papers were not mentioned. So I'm curious as to why that's so.
So I was in Chicago working with a homeless when Streetwise started. It's a wonderful paper, and of course, like all across the nation, in Boston, there's a very active street paper and so on. But many of the vendors, of course, are men, homeless men, often childless folk. It's much harder for parents to do that kind of work, but we didn't happen among the 18 families we followed to identify that as a survival strategy, but certainly many entrepreneurial trades were practiced kind of in a dizzying array. You know, the entrepreneurship of these folks was nothing short of phenomenal. But we also point out in the book that when you're having to be that entrepreneurial to squeeze a few dollars out of selling tin cans so you can buy your kids socks and underwear, the mental energy, the bandwidth you need, right, to get ahead, to think about the future, is completely sapped by the demands of just getting by day to day. So I'm a big fan of Streetwise, and what's great about street newspapers is they've kind of taken an informal activity and given it some legitimacy and even dignity. There's a gentleman outside selling your street newspapers. So we need to think of more ways of doing that, and it's great that you raised that example.
Yeah. Thank you.
In the book, you talk a great deal about the philosophy behind the welfare reform. And it seemed that you were very focused on work, as many people wanted to work. And many of the cases you've either talked about tonight or that were in the book needed very small things in some instances to allow to allow work to happen, such as transportation. But there's also the very large thing for families of childcare. And for the jobs you're talking about your people having, childcare itself is more expensive than the wage they would earn. How do we reconcile those very almost not cost-effective issues of working?
So Clinton administration did sort of bargain with Congress when welfare reform was signed, so we got more money for childcare. States can opt to use their TANF funds for childcare. Illinois has been one state that has done that. Oklahoma was doing that, but now it's decided it needs to use the money to fund its child welfare system. Of course, this is pure substitution, right? The state used to assume that cost. So again, this is a governor who can't resist the slush fund that TANF has become. So it is absolutely a problem. It's something that does hinder work. What's really amazing, though, about the $2 a day poor is how work active they are. So even among the poorest Americans living below that $2 a day threshold, most of those folks are trying to work. They see themselves as workers, as you know. They have this strong worker identity. What we have done, as you're pointing out, is we've created a work-based safety net. If you work, we give you tax credits. We support you in various ways. We no longer cut you off of Medicaid, but we haven't really made it feasible for a lot of Americans to balance work and family. When you look at the people who left the welfare rolls in the late 1990s for work, the vast majority of those people were mothers with preschool children. So, huge issue. States are spending some, though not enough, of their dollars on childcare. And you know, the supply is far outstripped by the demand.
And the way you resolve that can get you involved with the child welfare system.
That's right.
All right. I know. Excuse me. I know people are really appalled by some of the stories that you mentioned. You know, I blame a lot the media, particularly how it fails to depict people who are not only experiencing poverty, but the homeless in America. It wasn't until I got on the streets myself that I understood that there was such a huge divide between people who have homes and people who are on the streets. In my mind, that is a current day crisis, and that is where all our energy should be focused. You know, we've overcome slavery, desegregation, women can vote. Oh, there's one more crisis, and that's homelessness. There's so many legal issues. There's only a couple of states that have even moved to bring it to an end. We're so misunderstood. The street paper, I don't think anyone has an idea of how powerful that is. It is our cottage industry right here in the United States. We're fortunate in Ann Arbor to have it, and Chicago has it. We're in 100 cities, and ironically, this is International Street Paper Vendor Week. People should be in the streets lifting us up and screaming because we work really hard. I mean, I lost my job as a Detroit public school teacher back in 2012. And people, I don't think, realize how fast that process can happen. You know, you have the savings and everything in place, but you know, there's a protracted time in getting access to it, and there's all kinds of stories. I could go on and on, but it can happen to anyone. It does happen, and there's no real social safety net. I mean, the sort of systemic the way that the society is structured in terms of housing, there's no way for you to to get traction, because if you're evicted, of course, that takes away your ability to get even a small room, okay, because it's all based on credit. Mm-hmm. So we need an overhaul, and it needs to be one that, of course, addresses, I think, the issue of homelessness. I have a sort of a sour taste in my mouth about some of the agencies, but that's because I've been on the streets and haven't really been able to connect with agencies the way that I feel we should. There are not a lot of us on boards, which, as we should be, we're not really considered in the diversity sort of conversation. You have feminist movements, the street woman's voice is not heard. Mm-hmm. So we've got a long way to go in focusing on what I feel is the real crisis. The blood issue, I just want to mention the plasma thing real fast, because this is Black History Month. There's so much going on. Dr. Charles Richard Drew was the African American who who invented the blood plasma thing. I remembered it from Black History Facts because his name was Drew and he drew blood. I doubt if he at that point thought that it would be something that would have to benefit people in poverty just trying to survive. You know, it's just the way history sort of plays itself out. But anyway, support the ground cover. We're one of the best street papers in the world. Thank you.
So, just to note, we couldn't agree more that the affordable housing crisis is a fundamental crisis, I think, challenge of the 21st century in this country, and that family homelessness takes a lot of forms. You know, it's amazing that you can hear many stories of people who were public school teachers, you know, own their own business, had worked for years, and, you know, people are often living on such an edge, you know, on such a razor-thin margin that some crisis happens and it things spiral down from there. And, we have a couple thoughts on the affordable housing crisis. One is that it is one thing that's underappreciated is that the affordable housing crisis is, I think, at least as much an income crisis as it is anything else. And the availability of stable income, Kathy has a study coming out of landlords in Cleveland, and you've got some bad actors in there, absolutely, but you also have people who are struggling with how do I stay afloat when people's jobs go up and down from month to month, and I only get the rent half of the time. So I think figuring out how we solve the income crisis is a big part of it. At the local level especially, we can, if we want to sort of look at the lens of what can we do, we need to look at zoning laws. Yeah. In a lot of places, what are the kind of housing units that can be built? Because that has been a way that relatively affluent places have kept, families without means from moving by creating zoning restrictions that don't allow things like apartments, that don't allow, I think, certain lot sizes. So this is something that, when we look at the nitty-gritty of how do we deal with the affordable housing crisis, I think we need to look at the federal level, where we've had stagnant the number of housing choice vouchers for a very long time, but all the way down to the local level, and what kind of housing can be built, and what does that say about the community, and who gets to live there? My friend Don.
Hi. So I did read the book, and so I got inspired to try and do something, and I just wanted to share one of the challenges that people would encounter trying to get additional cash. So one of the local grocery chains needs lots of people. So I got to the store manager and said, I know where there are a lot of people that need jobs, but they can't get here. And would you be interested in helping solve that problem? And they said, sure, we'd explore any kinds of reasonable opportunities. So then I go over to Ypsilanti, to Michigan Works, and talk to them about, okay, I've got somebody over here that could potentially use people. They could use them during the day from 9 to 3. So I was thinking, you know, single moms, maybe while the kids are in school. And as we talk a little further, and I'm talking to the director there, and he said, you know, Don, they get $800 a month, and I believe I have these numbers right. But if they take the part-time job, that drops to about $200 a month. So in talking to the store, you know, the maximum they're going to guarantee them is 30 hours. So if you take 30 and maybe they clear 7, so that's, say, $200 a week. So they might make $800 a month if they come to work. On the other hand, if they don't come to work, they're going to make, so 800 plus 200 would be 1,000. But if they don't come to work and don't go through all that hassle, they make 800. So I thought, you got a great idea. Let's get some extra cash for these folks. And if, again, if my numbers are right, the Michigan plans really stand in the way of those people being able to get the cash that they need to address some of the needs. So again, as you look at the policies, maybe that would be one you can research some more. Thank you.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the successes, so Kathy wrote this book before $2 a Day called It's Not Like I'm Poor, which is about the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is one of the big successes of the 1990s, providing a big subsidy through the tax code. And so I've always been a little bit jealous that I only got to tell the Debbie Downer side, and Kathy got to do both. But often I think in calculations like that, we don't take that into account, that the EITC is actually ramps up as you make more money. But it comes at tax time, right? So it's often not there when a crisis happens. And it's also not a safety net, right? Because it disappears when you're not working. But we did see this surge into the labor market of families who really responded, I think, mostly to increasing the benefits of work. So, you know, one thing I think that this incredible scenario, and thank you for in doing some work and making connections, is that this stuff really isn't easy. Like, we don't want to make it sound like we can very quickly sort of solve problems. You know, there's a lot of different ways, I think, to make those connections work. First of all, I think there's probably a lot of people that even at only a $200 increase would like to work. And then also, you know, maybe there's a way to get the wage up a little bit, right? A lot of times we can't find workers, but, well, maybe if it was $10, maybe it was $11, maybe that changes sort of the calculus. And I think also we have to take into account that working costs money. That's often the challenge, is that when you work, you have to, as we said, find childcare, you have to buy work clothes, you have to pay for transportation. So figuring out how to reduce those costs are part of it. But it's going to take, I think it takes work and it takes a lot of conversation to figure out exactly how to put the pieces together.
So what's really amazing, going all across the country and talking to these folks and also looking at the numbers, is that even though you do sometimes see these benefit cliffs, we call them, as you point out, people still want to work, and they still make that trade-off. And I think part of that is that work has become so central, even in the identities of young women who have preschool children. You know, they really see themselves fundamentally as workers. And part of the reason, of course, they see themselves as workers is because they want to contribute to their communities. They want to participate. They want to be like everyone else, and play by the same rules that everybody else is playing by. The other thing we have to remember is not only will the tax credits help people who do take those jobs in big time, right? They could get a $5,000 to $7,000 check every year at tax time if they make that trade-off. Welfare is going away. It's disappearing every year. We used to have about 5 million adults on the rolls. As of the publication of $2 a Day, we had about 1 million adults on the rolls.
There are now only 750,000 adults left on the welfare rolls in the United States. Half of them are in just two states, California and New York, meaning that across the entire country, there are only 375,000, 400,000 adults left on TANF. Every year that number goes down. And I don't see anything in the political climate right now to suggest that that's not going to continue to happen. So, you know, people already think welfare is dead. If you go out into the community and you're not going through the welfare office, but you're just talking to people in hard times, many times TANF won't even come to mind. People will say they've never heard of the program. And that's because it has become so rare. So, very interesting. But I'm betting there are other sources out there, other places where you could find folks who are really interested in making that trade-off and taking those jobs. So keep going.
Very much appreciate the groundbreaking work you guys are doing and the light that you're shining here. I have a question. This is an incredibly complex issue, but I'm going to ask what hopefully is a simplifying question for someone who's just trying to get his mind around, okay. So here's a question. What's my biggest blind spot? What's my biggest myth? And what is an example of a place or a program that has figured out and sort of got it right? So blind spot, myth, and someone who's figured out how to be helpful here.
So if I had to guess, I would say the first blind spot is something like, oh, I've never met someone who's had experiences like these, right? And I think chances are that you walk down the street with someone or you know, given your order to someone or bumped into someone at the public library who has a story that could have been in the book. The case that comes to mind for me is that when I met Madonna Harris in Chicago, I went down for a full sort of 2 days, me and my daughter, who was 3 at the time, and met Madonna and Jennifer Hernandez and Susan Brown, and then Kathy sent me to bed because I was ashen-faced, you know. So Bridget and I went back to our hotel, and my wife and her mom, Susie, was at a conference in Chicago, too. So I met Madonna Harris, and I had dinner with her. I heard her story, and I came back to Michigan, and I thought about her a lot, but I never expected to see her again. And then my family was back in Chicago, we were going to go do, I was certainly not thinking about Madonna Harris then. We were going to do Shedd's Aquarium, maybe the Field Museum. And it was my job to go down and get the coffee in the morning at a Starbucks. And I have my coffee, and I run into Madonna and Brianna on the street. And, you know, at first I'm like, should I say hello? You know, it's like there's this, you know, this intimacy of like knowing her story and having this time together, but also sort of, you know, an awkwardness of not having seen her for a long time. And finally I said hello and we hugged and I got a little bit of an update. But I just thought, you know, how many times do you walk by someone who is experiencing this? And it's a security, it's a survival strategy to stay hidden a lot of the time, right? And to not, you know, we all probably have things that we don't just tell people. You know, being not having any money is a big one. So I think we're often sort of in this myth that somehow we're totally insulated from it, and we're just not. So that was your blind spot. The second, the myth is, and I don't know if this is true of you, but it's true of a lot of people, is that poor families don't want to work. Yeah. And, you know, by the numbers and by the families we met, nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, single moms in the United States work a great deal more than single moms in any other advanced industrialized country. So by any standard of human, you know, experience, it's just utterly false. And so I think this is a myth that has perpetuated a lot of policy. And you know, just doesn't accurately, as far as any evidence that we've had, depict the circumstances of the majority of families. Although true for some, maybe, it's just not the overall story. I forget what the third.
The third is what's working.
Oh, what's working? What is?
Well, you know, so we have 14 policy recommendations at the end of the
14?
Book.
I thought 14. Our editor wouldn't let us have more.
No, we have 14.
Okay, all right.
I counted them recently. But perhaps my favorite is really directly in response to what we've now called the Ray McCormick problem. In fact, we had the White House calling it the old White House, calling it the Ray McCormick program too. And they were trying to figure out ways to get things into the budget to help Ray get that gas money so she could keep that job at Walmart. But we tried during the recession strategy in about 23 states where states could use TANF dollars to help employers, private sector employers, and create jobs they couldn't otherwise afford to create. So offered a partial wage subsidy for these jobs. And it was an enormously successful program. The employers loved it. Many of the jobs that were created remained after the subsidy ended. And so you should talk about the Michigan version of this. But we think the best of these programs would include a series of what are known as concierge services, which is kind of a strange phrase, to indicate that that a supported work program would partner with a community provider, a social service agency that would come alongside of the family and help them with all of the tumultuous aspects of their personal lives, their child care difficulties, their housing dilemmas, in ways that support them in keeping that job. So do you want to talk about what's happening here in Michigan?
Yeah, so this is a lot of what we're sort of striking out to look at the University of Michigan through Poverty Solutions is looking at different models and finding out, are they effective, do they work, and can they be replicated? So, you know, one of the things I'm really excited about is we've been working with the United Way and Washtenaw County and the Ginsburg Center here on campus, you know, all these amazing organizations to talk about the opportunity gap in Washtenaw County. And through that, we learned that we have some resources for summer youth jobs, but maybe not as many as we can. And so out of that, the University of Michigan made a commitment to make available 50 summer youth jobs placements here at U of M for families with low income, and to use it as a way, I think, to figure out how do we make the University of Michigan a more open and inviting place to a broad range of people, and you know, how can we do summer programs, summer youth jobs programs that build on a lot of the resources here at the University of Michigan. So I'm excited about that, and we're you know, that's sort of one of the examples of trying to bring the resources of the University of Michigan to bear on challenges in a very action-based way. You know, as Kathy was saying, you know, to me a lot of it depends a little bit less when we think about sort of social service programs. It matters a little bit less exactly what you do, although I want to figure out exactly, you know, what the best ways to do things are, but this question of how you do it. And it's mm-hmm. clear that, you know, whether you call it a coach or a partner
or a mentor,
somebody who comes alongside families who are struggling in a positive, forward-looking way. So one thing I like to say is if a poor family is looking for someone to tell them what they're doing wrong with their life, they will have no problem finding someone who will tell them exactly how they're screwing things up. And what we need a lot more of, I think, is programs that work with people in positive ways to solve problems, connect with resources. You know, so I think of WIC. WIC is an incredibly popular program among those that get it. And just, you know, a sign, you know, WIC is additional supplement for low-income families. And a sign of sort of where we are as a country, 50% of infants receive a WIC, one in two. is an incredibly popular program. It has a lot of knowledge transfer, you know, and to me, I would often think, well, this is a paternalistic program. It's not something we should do, but it's done, I think, in a dignified way. And so it's seen as, you know, here, not always, right? There's lots of different WIC offices, but it's often seen as a way that people can, that parents can get knowledge to do right by their babies, right? Which is what, you know, they want to be doing, just like all moms. So, you know, I think looking for ways in the way we deliver our programs and the way we do our community service, right, our social service, that really makes those human connections and helps, you know, provide resources to look forward and solve problems is a key. I want to make sure we get everybody's.
We only have 6 minutes, so
we'll try to do rapid fire answers.
But what we could do is just have all five of you who are standing there now ask your questions, and then maybe we can make some general comments based on them. So maybe we'll start here and just go back and forth till we get all five of you heard.
What else is on the bonus reel? Maybe in terms of a tangential story like Travis and his truck, more of someone's life, or commentary that didn't fit or might be saved for a future collaboration. Or maybe in terms of, you mentioned that you ran into people who thought welfare was completely gone and maybe were in places where it still was there. The size or quality of that notion and impact it had or maybe is still having in the places where it is somewhat accessible.
Great.
I would just like to remind everyone as they leave tonight that there is a real live homeless person outside this building. His name is Tony. He is selling the Ground Cover News. And Tony is outside the building in the rainy weather because he was told he could not sell in the lobby. So please say hello to Tony on your way out. Minimum is a dollar. He would be glad to take anything above that that you can.
In 1990, I graduated from U of M Social Work School. The state actually put me through school because I was working in mental health at the time, and they put a lot of people through school. As soon as I graduated, I became unemployed 4 months later when they shut down the mental health institution where I worked. Then I eventually got a job working in Detroit at Detroit Central City Community Mental Health. And they had just stopped general assistance, where people got $100 a month so that they could barely survive on $100, and now they had nothing. Mm-hmm. And so one lady, she couldn't stop shaking. She'd come to the office and just sit there and shake the whole time because she was so terrified of what was going to happen when she was going to be on the street. And she didn't have mental illness, believe me. What she needed was an income. And another person had AIDS, and he said to me, they just want me to die. Mm. So things like that, I'm sorry I voted for Stein because I couldn't stand thinking of how it happened that all these people lost their assistance when Clinton was in. And I made a mistake, but you know, it's really hard to vote for somebody who takes away stuff from the poor.
My name is Janice Fox, and I'm from Volunteers of America, HPOG, and we have a federal grant that helps those on TANF cash and food assistance gain education opportunities in the healthcare field. And I just had a quick question and comment. One, the question, the comment is, I thought your book was excellent, and I thought that it gave a good glimpse of what people are going through and some solutions. But I think that the main solution really is education. So when you notice in a lot of the cases that if the education levels were higher in a lot of the situations, that would have helped a lot of the issues. And also the question is, we have a lot of participants who use our program wisely and really helps them go up the career ladder. We have a lot of others, though, who struggle with going up the career ladder and really using our services. And what are some suggestions you would have for those that don't take advantage of the opportunities that are presented to them? And how would you suggest that what we should do to try to help motivate them more or actually take part in some of these opportunities that they're getting?
Hi. I've been a nurse for 34 years, and for the last 15, I've been working with this population. And we're about to launch another campaign, and it's called Time to Care. Because the low-income workers that are in this situation, when they get sick, have no paid time to be sick. So that's a problem for them, but it's also a problem for everybody else, because they're making your fast food while there's got Norwalk virus. They're taking care of the people in the nursing home while they've got Norwalk virus. And they're spreading strep through wherever they're working, because they can't take any time off, because they have to feed their kids, and because they have to pay their rent. And so we're about to start this campaign again. We're hoping to have it on the ballot in 2018, and I really strongly encourage people to sign up. There's one more comment I want to make about fast food. We have a lot of low-income workers working in fast food, and the wages are slowly coming up because there's a whole situation going on with staffing them. But the problem is they get hired and they get told they're going to get 30 hours, but if the business is slow in the middle of the afternoon, they get home, they get sent home with no pay. Right. And so there's no guarantee of those hours really being right there. And the last thing I'm going to say is lots of people, think about big things, but the clinic I worked in, we were giving shots to kids, and we would often pull their pants down so we could give shots to small children in their legs, because that's the safest place to find out they had no underwear.
Yeah.
Because they just can't afford it. So one of the things that we did to try to get the kids' dignity was to get underwear. And we asked a whole lot of civic groups to do that. We also collect, and still are collecting, soap from hotels. So if you go on vacation, save the little bottles out of the home, out of the hotel, and bring them to either one of the schools in Ipsy or one of the clinics in Ipsy. We all need them. And we put them out in baskets, and that's how people stay clean.
Yeah. I'm going to... There's so many important stories and solutions in this room, but I am going to let my dear friend and your hometown hero have the last word.
Do you remember anything else on the bonus reel?
Bonus reel. Well, there's a lot on the bonus reel. Wait for the next edition.
The question about welfare is dead. This was a big thing that we found, that people, and you can see this in the data, that it's not so much, there are times when people are turned away, like when Ray McCormick finally went in and was told, honey, there's just so many people who need help, come back next year, right? So that happens, but we do know that a lot of people just don't know about the program. And some of that's that people aren't getting it. It's also, not totally a surprise, right? People, we do a lot more outreach for SNAP, food stamps, for healthcare, public health insurance, than we do, I don't think there's probably a single state that says, hey, come get on TANF. The fact that I think there are these perverse incentives that I think unfairly trap governors in a spider webs of welfare dependency and using their money, their welfare dollars, to do other stuff, it's a structural issue that I think we have to tackle. I love this point about mental health being an income problem. So we have a very greatly admired colleague, Greg Duncan, and some others who are doing a child allowance study. So one way to get over these marginal tax rates, these benefits cliffs, is to make it a universal benefit and say, you know what, raising kids is expensive. We're going to provide a small stipend to all families. It turns out we already do this in the United States through the child exemption. through the tax code. It's just not something that poor families get because it's not, you know, something at the very bottom. It's not refundable. So this is something we could do, and there'd be no benefit cliff. You'd get to keep that money no matter what. It'd also be a universal program. And he's, you know, we've seen some work that a small amount of money infused into a family's budget can make a great deal of difference on stress in the family, on, you know, it's interesting, we have these studies from casinos where money sort of randomly gets distributed on tribes, on tribal lands, and we see big declines in alcohol utilization and a lot of mental health, positive mental health markers. The only thing I do want to say on that particular set of questions is that Hillary Clinton did not pass the 1996 welfare reform. That was her husband. I think we can all agree her husband did a lot of things that maybe Hillary wouldn't do. And, you know, and if we're going to sort of judge her on the record of the 1990s, I think from an empirical fact, then we have to give her a lot of credit for the major expansion of public health insurance. One of the other, I think, very positive things that we did in the 1990s. So finally, I think I just want to say time to care and this hours issue, incredibly important, where we would see people who would get sent home or are on call shifts. You're still employed, but we don't have any hours for you. And what exactly does that mean? Some of that actually is in response to another policy structure through unemployment insurance, where if you officially lay people off, then they can get unemployment insurance. If they're working for you, even if they don't get 0 hours, it's much harder to claim the benefit. And this is sort of another unique thing that we do in the United States. But I think from the business case, I think there's a lot of bills out there that are sort of ways, possible ways to tackle some of these issues of these non-standard, flexible, you know, these shifts and swings and hours from week to week and month to month, which also messes with your benefits, sort of in the way that that Don mentioned. And so I think those are good things to explore. I think we also have to make the case to companies that they should treat their workers better, or you know, maybe we'll take our money other places. So, you know, there's some really good examples of that. And the time to care, I think, is a big issue. We've seen a couple states who have put in place paternity leave policies. And so I think that'll be fertile ground to see. There's others that are considering it, and we'll, you know, see if that's sort of a direction we can move. It is actually something that's being discussed in Washington right now. You know, I think there are ways to do some of these things in universal policies rather than targeting poor families in a way that lifts everybody up has longer, you know, the greatest anti-poverty program that we've had in the United States is Social Security. Yeah. So, you know, if we can look to structures, I think, to solve some of these that benefit everybody, I think they have longer term viability. We have to stop. This was a highlight for us, I think.
Yeah, we're going to be out signing books in just a minute, visit those tables out there. And it was just an honor to spend the last 90 minutes with all of you. Thank you.